Hi. So thank you everyone once again for joining us today for this very interesting webinar on lessons learned from four-day work week experiments with Professor Brendan Burchell. Professor Burchell is a professor of sociology at the University of Cambridge. He's specializing in work time reduction and the 4-day work week. And he was a principal researcher for the UK's groundbreaking 2022 experiment analyzing the 4-day work week. So Professor Burchell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank
And the
you.
floor is
Right, let
yours.
me share my slides, and let me tell you the about the research that I've been doing. Really, this is something I've been particularly interested in for the last 8 years, and I must emphasize it's not just me doing this work. I've had a team of people at the University of Cambridge, and we collaborate very closely with academics from several other universities, in particular Boston College in the US, have been very important partners in some of this research, so don't think I'm trying to claim all the credit for this work. I've always been interested in people's well-being and how that relates to the world of work. But in the last 8 years or so, I've been focusing more narrowly on the hours that we work and how that affects our well-being. So let me give you an overview of why isn't this moving? Right. Okay, all right. The things stopped working then for a minute. I'm going to talk about why employment is good for us. Now, I know lots of people these days focus on all the bad things about employment, the way it stresses us out, all the occupational diseases that people get. I still think that to keep things in proportion, there's a lot more benefit to employment. And I'll talk about that first, why employment is so important for most of us, not for everyone, but there are some really bad jobs out there, but for most of us, even in average jobs, we benefit from them. I'll talk about those. And then I'll go on to talk about what happens when people work shorter hours, particularly when we collectively, as an employer or even as a country, reduce working time and the benefits that we get. And I'll be looking in particular at two sources of information. The first was the biggest experiment of its kind was done in the UK, although we had very similar but smaller experiments we did in many other countries now, in the United States, Ireland, Canada, Germany, France, South Africa. And they've all had similar sorts of data. So what happens when a whole load of companies all sign up to reduce their working time? But in particular, I'll also look at something that happened by coincidence, really, quite close to the University of Cambridge, which is the our local district council, our local government, that now have been working for a 4 day week for, well, about 2.5 years now. And there, I'm particularly interested in that because we got some really good evidence there on the performance of the organization since they reduced their hours down to 4 days a week. Just to start off with, I'm talking a lot about people's mental health. And just to be clear what I'm talking about there, there's lots of different people talking about now. It gets entered into all sorts of discourses. Some people talk about it very loosely. I'm talking about it in a very specific way, in a way that we can measure. And in particular, sometimes when people talk about mental health, they particularly focus on ill health when people have, say, anxiety or depression-related problems. I'm not so much interested in that extreme ends where people have got mental illness. I'm interested in it as being on a continuum. Probably you could imagine it as on something like a bell-shaped curve, where lots of us have got average health. Some days we're happy, sometimes we're not so happy. Sometimes we deal well with challenges, sometimes we don't. We're, average in that way. There are then people who are more prone to symptoms of anxiety and depression. And there are people at the other end who are flourishing, who have got really good mental health, I suppose, equivalent to being an athlete in terms of physical health, but they can deal very well with, say, challenges that life throws up at them. And there's all sorts of reasons why people might have different places on that continuum. Partly genetic, it does seem some people are born with a a happy gene and some without. But a lot of it's to do with our life circumstances, our family life, our finances, but our employment plays a big part in that art, and I'll show you why I think that later. It's measured in different ways. Sometimes we look for symptoms of anxiety and depression as indicators, more not necessarily clinical levels, but more normal symptoms. Sometimes we measure people's happiness. We ask them how happy they are. Sometimes, maybe a bit more seriously, we ask them how satisfied they are with their life, either their life as a whole or with particular aspects of their life. For my purposes, I tend to use big data sets where I don't often have a choice in which of these measures are available. But as far as I can see, for the research I do, it doesn't matter much which of these measures I use. We get very similar results, whichever these ways we got measuring it. Here's one measure which I particularly use. It's recommended by WHO, the World Health Organization, and it's particularly useful for European use and international use because it translates well into so many different languages, which is difficult for some of these more subjective emotional feelings. And so you might want to just think about how you would respond if you were filling in one of my questionnaires. And I typically ask people to indicate how they've been feeling over the last 2 weeks. And we give them five statements. On each of those statements, they answer on a 6-point scale from none of the time to all of the time. So I'll ask you whether you felt cheerful and in good spirits in the last 2 weeks, whether you felt calm and relaxed, whether you felt active and vigorous, whether you wake up feeling fresh and rested, and whether you'd say that your life has been filled with things that interest you. So you can see how it's a in this way of measuring it, it's a looking at very positive things that we ought to we aspire to be able to enjoy life and take it in our stride. Those are the sorts of measures I use. And when we give it to large samples of people, and one of the things that may be slightly surprising to sociologists is that we get very similar results in pretty much all the certainly more, wealthier, industrialized and post-industrial societies where we ask these sorts of questions, that we f tend to find, for instance, that people who are married are healthier than people who are single. We find that people who are divorced and those people who are recently separated have got particularly poor mental health. Again, no surprise there. But when you look at a graph like this, and here we've got all these groups compared to the comparison group here is a female who's employed and is single. When we look at people who are unemployed, that clearly, of all those different obvious causes of happiness and unhappiness, has the biggest effect. So being without a job, without a doubt, for most people, not for everybody, I'm talking on averages here, but for the vast majority of people, being unemployed seems to have a very detrimental effect on your well-being. And just to be clear, there's lots of different ways of measuring that. You could say, is it a false correlation? Is it because people who've got poor mental health, maybe addiction problems or chronic depression, find it more difficult to find jobs and hold them down? Well, yes, it's partly that, but it's also very directly causal. When we follow the same people over time, when those people lose a job, their mental health goes down. And when they go back into employment, it goes up again. So it's very directly a very clear causal relationship. One thing that is a bit more controversial is how we account for that. What is it about employment that is so good for our well-being? And here there's several different theories, and I'm not going to go into all of them. I'm just going to describe one that's been particularly influential. It was one developed by Marie Yehuda, who, when she was first doing her research in this in the 1920s in Austria, but continued to be interested in unemployment right up to the beginning of the 21st century, when she was well into her 90s. And she said basically, some things changed, but the big picture didn't change. And the surprising finding that she came across, even when people were living with such lower levels of income in the 1920s, is that actually the wage, you could say, well, obviously the reason we go to work is for the money. But actually, the wage or the loss of the wage when you're unemployed accounts for very little of the negative mental health that we see when people lose their jobs. Instead, Marie Hoder said, it was the unintended, the accidental, the latent functions, as she called them, of employment that promoted well-being, not so much the wage. And if we look at what it is that she said these unintended consequences of work are, and she listed five. Again, other people have come out with other lists and suggested other things you could add to this list, but the five that she gave was that work gave you time structure, you know when to get up in the morning, you know when you finish work for the day, and the rest of the day is for you or for your family or whatever. It gives you regular enforced activity, not sitting around trying to find things to do, ruminating. It gives you social contact outside of your family. And she says that other employees typically are a lot more gentle sometimes with our emotions than our own family are. You know, families can be quite emotionally charged places, particularly when you've got teenage children involved or family, close family relationships. Fourthly, she says work gives us collective purpose. We feel that we're doing something that's important. It gives us meaning in life, that we're doing it with other people, not just looking after ourselves in this world. And finally, it gives us status and identity. We respect people through their occupation in our societies, and it's very difficult for people to who are unemployed to admit that, to talk about the fact they don't have that identity, that status at the time. So there you are. That's the a way of looking at why work is good for you. There's other things we could talk about as well, the security and so on, but there you are. The question that I asked myself about 8 years ago was, okay, work's good for you. All the evidence, that, you know, overwhelming evidence to show that. We've got good support for your Hoder's theory. But whenever anyone tells you something's good for you, the question I always want to ask is, what's the best dose of it? How much is not enough? And how much is too much? And most things that doctors tell us now we need to do more of or less of, they'll tell us how much we should be doing. Say for sleep, we know that doctors say that between 7 and 9 hours is probably optimal. If you sleep a lot more than that or less than that, it's not so good for you. They'll tell us how much salt we need in our diet. Again, there's an optimal amount, not too much, not too little. Calories, how much sunlight we need, how much vitamin C. You know, I'm wearing my special, you know, Fitbit watch, so I know how many steps I've done a day, which are meant to be good for me. But what about paid work? And that I could find there was some evidence, and it's again quite clear evidence, that when people are working very long hours, it's bad for them. And the cut-off point tends to come at, say, about 45 hours a week, and maybe a lot less than that. There's some research from Australia now suggesting that, say, for women with children, once they go over about 32 hours a week, their mental health starts to decline. Anyway, it's very clearly not the very long hours that, like Jack Ma is claiming, the 9-9-6, working from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, 6 days a week. That clearly isn't good for you, and there's very good evidence, not just for your mental health, but also your physical health, your musculoskeletal problems, and your ability to be a good parent, to take part in society, and so on. So, working too much is bad for you. No surprises there. But what about how little we work? What's the minimum amount of paid work that's needed in order to get those benefits, to have the mental health that's more similar to someone who's in employment rather than that low mental health that we saw associated with unemployment? One thing that's just as interesting, when I start talking about how work could be very different, and I say, you know, why do we work for 8 hours a day? Why do we work 5 days a week? The reaction I got, particularly before the pandemic, was very much, well, it's just that's natural. That's the way that things have always been. People almost as if they talk as if it's in the book of Genesis or something. And clearly it's not. I mean, just to emphasize, this idea of having about a 5 day week, having a 2 day weekend, working about 40 hours a week is something that came to the United States about 100 years ago. It came to the United Kingdom a bit after that. Other countries have followed suit later. In some countries in China, it was only in the 1990s they went really to having a 2 day weekend. in the USSR, it was 1960s. But at different countries, at some point in the last 100 years, have all made this shift towards this the 8-hour day and the five days a week. Henry Ford was particularly instrumental in making that change in the United States, thinking that his workers would be more productive if they weren't tired all the time, and they'd have more time to drive cars, and therefore would be more likely to buy his cars as well. So he did it for performance. In other countries, it was trade unions and government that tried to regulate down those working hours, achieved different ways in different countries. In the EU, we had the Working Time Directive. But yeah, like I say, with some reason, we seem to have now stagnated on that model. In the United States and in the United Kingdom in particular, it hasn't changed that much in the last 100 years. It has gone down slightly, but not much. And like I say, before the pandemic, when I said I was very interested in people working much reduced hours, I was often looked at by my colleagues as well as by journalists and saying, well, you're a bit of a fantasist. Why don't you concentrate on real world problems? I do notice since the pandemic, people have become a lot more open to, very different ways of working, particularly since, working from home became so much normal. And now people do have much more imagination about how things might be different. The other thing that spurred interest in working time reduction, and I'll just mention this briefly, is those news stories that came out over 10 years ago now, suggesting that robots and big data, artificial intelligence, might be able to do maybe even half of the jobs that are currently done by humans, and therefore we could be facing mass unemployment if half of the people lost their jobs, for instance, in some of the extreme scenarios. And actually, although that seemed a very far-fetched scenario 10 years ago, with the very rapid advances we've seen with AI even in the last year or two, it is something I think we should take seriously and think, what are we going to do about it? Are we really going to put up with mass unemployment? Are we going to invent new jobs for people who lose their jobs because of AI? Or what about if all of us started to work shorter hours? So that was, again, one of the things that got me thinking about it. And one of the bits of research which I did, again, this is a few years, this is like 6 or 7 years ago now, before the pandemic, and so many things changed with the pandemic, I did, with my team in Cambridge, look at that relationship between the hours that people worked and their well-being. And before doing that, I asked around lots of my colleagues and said, what do you think in terms of hours of work? Where would we get the optimal level? What's the optimum number? And some people saying, yeah, maybe 4 days a week, maybe 3 days a week. In fact, what we found, and it wasn't what I predicted or anyone else predicted, it didn't seem to matter how much you worked in terms of hours per week. If it was anywhere between 1 day a week and 5 days a week, you had the same mental health benefits. It was only when you went below 1 day a week, suddenly your mental health got worse and you looked more like someone who was unemployed. So that was the first really, I think, important evidence. And it was well covered in the newspapers in the UK and the US. Sometimes it was treated quite lightheartedly, saying that I was saying that we should take 6 day weekends and work 1 day. We weren't saying that. And of course, you need to earn some money. But what we were saying is a society where as many people as possible are not excluded from the labour market through unemployment or through economic inactivity, being full-time carers, for instance, full-time parents, but are included in the labour market is going to do a lot for the mental health of that nation. The other thing that became clear as we went on through that research is there's a massive difference between reducing your own hours, which I've done, where you get better work-life balance, you get more time for your hobbies, which seem to be good for your well-being and so on. You're not leading your life in such a hurry anymore. But there are negatives to it as well. You don't get paid as much if you reduce your hours in most jobs. You lose out on seniority. You're less likely to get promoted. You're not going to get such a big pension. So there are winners and losers. So that's why the next big step, and this is what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of this seminar, is what happens when everybody reduces their hours together. And this is what happened. Coming out of the pandemic, we were looking at organizations where they decided back in 2022 that everybody should work a 4-day week. And this wasn't by a compressed hours model. It wasn't that they started working 4 long days and did the same hours in 4 days as they had been in five, but a genuine 20%, hopefully, reduction in their working hours. All of these employers were given coaching of how they're going to achieve that, how they needed to reorganize work, how they do it in their organization. And we took very good measures of particularly employee well-being at the beginning, the middle, and the end of this period to see how employees benefited from it. They'd all did it differently. Some businesses, you could just close up on a Friday. You're not having to answer the phones or respond to emails on a Friday. You could just, the business only operated Monday to Thursday. Other businesses had to operate 5 days a week, so maybe half of the employees would get Monday off and half Friday off. Others rotated the days off. And even some organizations had annualized hours so that the people got more time off in the quiet time of the year, maybe the winter, and worked longer hours in the, for instance, in the tourist season. So there were lots of different ways of doing it. But the thing that they all had in common was they attempted to reduce their working hours by up to 20%. Some it was only 10%, it varied and they went through different phases. What happened? When we compare at the beginning and end of the trial, physical health improved. We got hundreds of measures. I'm not going to show you all the measures, literally hundreds of measures. People's mental health improved considerably. Levels of anxiety went down. People's positive emotions they felt, feeling vigorous, feeling interested, cheerful, they went up. Negative emotions went down. And these were big effects. These weren't small effects. And these were by averaging together the 3,000 employees in those 61 companies and seeing what was happening to them. We noticed their sleep quality improved. They did more exercise. They had more time for their hobbies, all sorts of measures that they responded positively on. Again, you could say, well, that's no big surprise. Obviously, that's what happens when you give people more time off. At the end of that 6-month period, we asked staff whether they'd enjoyed working on a 4-day week. Overwhelmingly, the response was positive. About 96% of employees said they wanted to continue that way. So there were some people who didn't like it, a very small proportion. People who maybe didn't have anything else in life, didn't have hobbies. Maybe for some reason their home environment was a hostile environment, where they preferred to found being at the office an easier life. But overall, like I say, very high levels of job satisfaction in this new way of working. 91 of the companies said they would definitely carry on with that way of working. And many of them initially made that a permanent change. Others wanted to continue to experiment. And there were lots of, there were minor teething problems that they wanted to iron out about, what happened when there was a bank holiday in the week, how you recalculated annual holidays depending on a 4-day week, and so on. So there were, I'm not saying there weren't teething problems, there were, but by and large, we got, it became permanent in many places. We also, and you could say again, and lots of people did say it was a fair comment, but that was a honeymoon period. 6 months, people are going to be on their best behavior. They're going to be working hard because they can get a reward. They'll go back to their old ways eventually. Well, we've been following these companies for another 2 years now, since 2022, and none of them have gone back to working a 5-day week. We continue to talk to them and yeah, they seem very happy continuing that they haven't slid back to their old ways, and they say they're benefiting from it. With those companies, we did ask about their performance, and it did seem, if anything, the evidence was that it was stayed the same or got better rather than got worse on average. But it wasn't great data. It was very subjective data. So that's why I'm going to come on to some other data which is much clearer on that. And just to say, at the time when that data hit the newspapers, and I think most people have seen about the 4-day week in the newspapers now. It's been even in the Times newspaper in the UK, had a big article on it just a couple of weeks ago. It's created a lot of interest. A lot of people really think that this is the way things are going to be. This is going to become the new norm. It's got, yeah, very positive reactions from employers and from employees. So let me go on to talk about the other case study. And this is just one company now, but a large and important company. This is South Cambridgeshire District Council. And this was more controversial because in the UK, like in the United States, government workers are controversial. There's a lot of people who, think that they're inefficient, and the idea if they have more time off, then they're going to be even more inefficient. People are going to scrutinize what they do much more closely, like has happened in the United States with Elon Musk recently, for instance. So this is, and again, this analysis, because it's so controversial, what happened to their when they went to working 4 day week, that's why they outsourced the analysis of that data to an HR company for the well-being data and to myself and my research team when they're looking at the key performance indicators, their performance. So South Cambridgeshire District Council, they're, if you like, they're like a donut. Geographically on the map, they look like a donut. So they're the whole area around the City of Cambridge. City of Cambridge has got a different government, local government. But this is the rural area around the City of Cambridge. And they've been having a hard time in the UK, again, not unlike other countries, particularly since the austerity, the big crash we had back in, what, 2008 and following on from that. And it seemed that whatever they did, they were facing very difficult problems. Cambridge and its surrounding area has been a big success story with the industry coming in based around the university and the science parks. So the population has gone up, but because of austerity that we've suffered, if anything, the budget for the councils has gone down. Their colleagues claimed they were exhausted a lot of the time. They couldn't recruit when they advertised for people to come work for Cambridge. They found it very difficult to fill vacancies because the salaries were below what you could get in the private sector in this booming part of the southeast of England. So not knowing and having tried lots of other things to fix these problems and found these problems almost impossible to solve, the decision of the elected member who was in what we call our Liberal Democrats Party, it's a centrist party, it's right in the middle between the Conservatives and Labour, and the unelected senior member of the council, the executive, agreed they were going to do a 4 day week. They started planning it at the end of 2022, having seen the results of that, those 61 cases that I just described. They decided to just do it for 3 months initially in case it was a total disaster and they could stop it and revert to working back to their normal hours. At the end of the additional 1 year trial, we did some detailed analysis on it, and that's the analysis I'm going to show you. Initially, it was just for the office workers, but later on, they included the waste collection trials, the guys who go around and collect the garbage. They were included as well. And this year, then they, having had 27 months of 4 day week data, they decided to do the analysis. And if it looked good enough, they were going to make it permanent. The way they organized it was that, roughly speaking, half of the people, employees, took Monday off and half took Friday off. So the opening hours, the times we could phone up the council, stayed the same. And those things that had to be 24/7, like when people had housing emergencies, again, they were available 24/7. So there was no reduction in working time. As far as the general public were concerned, they shouldn't even notice that things had changed. I mean, they were told, it was done with transparency. And in particular, all of the employees were told that if they could make it work, if they could find ways of working more efficiently, then this could become the new norm. So, what happened to the well-being data? And I'm not going to pause on this. There was another company that did this. This is a typical, if you like, dashboard that they produced before the trial started. And all the pink stuff means it's not going so well. So you can see across all sorts of motivation at work and mental health at work, there's more pink than green. It doesn't look good. After 3 months, suddenly everything looks a lot better. Everything's turned green on this graph. And again, was there backsliding? If we look at what happened after 15 months, Again, at the next slide, no, things continued at exactly the same rates. There's no evidence that it was just a honeymoon effect. What did people do differently? Well, one thing they didn't do, which I've been genuinely worried that we might be putting pressure on the people to work under time pressure all the time, to have tight deadlines, which we know is bad for people's mental health, having time, constant time pressure. That didn't seem to be the way. People found better ways of working. Suddenly, when you've got a whole organization of people, many of them had never even thought seriously about efficiency, started to really focus on, when they were wasting time, what didn't need doing. And one thing that happened here, like lots of other places, typically, meetings got shorter and smaller. And so many organizations said, we used to have a meeting, everybody comes to the meeting on Friday morning, on Monday morning, it would go on for 2 hours. Now we have five people come to that meeting and it's half an hour. People communicated differently. There's less procrastination. People got on and made decisions and so on. There was, just generally cutting out wasted time. In terms of the problems that they were trying to solve, staff turnover reduced dramatically. So people just weren't leaving in the same way. Not surprisingly, they really enjoyed working 4 days a week. When they advertised for jobs, they got a lot more jobs, more people applying for those jobs, and better quality people as well. So they could fill the jobs that often had remained vacant. One of the big costs for the council was employing agency workers because they couldn't fill roles permanently. They're also having to pay a lot of golden handcuffs, I think they're called in the States, what we call golden hellos, to attract people in and make sure they stay there for a minimum period. They weren't having to do that anymore because people genuinely, wanted to work. Word went round that this was a 4 day a week employer. So in that way, they solved their problems. And part of the reason they'd become so inefficient was they had so many agency workers. You'd phone up the council to have a fairly simple problem solved. The person you got on the phone would be an agency worker. They'd only been working there for a week. They'd have to get in touch with someone else to find the problem. We don't have that anymore. They don't need hardly use agency workers anymore because they can fill vacancies. But the sort of data that me and my team are looking at, and this was something that was really useful for us as, social scientists, they had really good data going back about 6 years. And so we could see what happened to their targets and how they met those targets over that 6 year period, sometimes 8 years. We could separate out what happened during the trial of the 4 day week compared to before. And we could also take account of COVID because, of course, that was the other big thing that was going on at this time, which made some targets much more difficult to attain and other ones easier. So this is a typical one of, and oh, sorry, and I should say there are 24 key performance indicators that we looked at. This is a typical one. How many days does it take when someone wants their housing benefits or their council tax updated? How many days does it take to bring about that change? And we've got, you can see this data month by month. Here we've displayed it quarter by quarter. And you can see that towards the beginning of the graph, it typically was often about 8 to 10 days was the norm for getting these problems dealt with. Towards the end, for that last period during the trial, the 4 day a week trial, it went down to about, between 6 and 4 days. So here we saw quite a dramatic improvement. And we did that for all 24 of the key performance indicators. And we didn't just look at the graphs, we did regressions. We had all that monthly data. We could look at seasonal effects. Some things are always better in summer than winter, and vice versa. We could factor in the COVID-19 lockdown periods. And what we found was running those regressions, getting rid of, sorting out the trial from those other things, was that of the 24 key performance indicators, about 11 of them at that point, after 15 months, actually got better. Not just held their own, but they got better during that time. About half of them stayed the same. And there was a couple of things that actually seemed to get worse. The amount of rent collected went down, and the average rate days to relet housing stock got worse. But I think for those two, there were other reasons why they went down. Housing, the rent collection, because we had a cost of living crisis. Again, like in the United States, we had that period of that real blip in inflation. And the reletting housing stock. A lot of that stock hadn't been repaired during COVID lockdown, so there was a lot more repair work that was needed. And that's always, it was a delayed effect of COVID that we hadn't accounted for. So, and these were things that other councils were really struggling with. So overall, it was a big success. How much did it cost, you might say? Well, actually, there were additional costs to get the waste collection done in 4 days rather than five. So, waste collection workers didn't work Mondays anymore. They need to buy more lorries. But overall, because they weren't using agency workers anymore, they weren't having to advertise at such a rate for recruitment, they weren't having to pay these recruitment incentives. They've seemed to have now saved about £400,000. What's that? About $500,000 year on year, consistently over the period of this trial. So it's actually saved the local taxpayers money. It was voted on in the councils about a month ago, and the big news is just from July, it's now permanent. So, South Cam's District Council, everybody works a 4 day week, a 32 hour week, and it's starting to be extended in the Cambridge City Council. Again, they've copied that because they share the waste collection and the planning services. So we're seeing this, as I think, is the start of a big growth in 4 day week work. I think we're just starting to see that now. There are other examples coming up, particularly in Scotland, too. So, there you are. To conclude, when individuals reduce their hours, working part time, in other words, there are costs and benefits that often seem to just about work out each well. But certainly, working at least 1 day a week definitely seems to have benefits. But when we have these collective hour reductions, now we've got very good evidence that well-being goes up, sick leave goes down, turnover goes down, all sorts of benefits to the individual and to the organisation. And now, with South Cams and that very detailed evidence there, and it's backed up from evidence we've got from the Scottish Government as well, if anything, performance actually gets better, not worse, once these people are focusing on how they're working. So I'm going to end it there, and I hope we'll have some questions.
Thank you so much. It was super, super interesting. So all our participants today, please feel free to share questions in the chat. But for now, I'll start with a few questions already. So first of all, do you think that these findings are universal? Should it work for every company, or there are some companies or some people for whom it would work actually the other way around?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Lots of the evidence comes primarily from office-based and white-collar professional type organisations. They're the ones who seem to have, generally speaking, signed up to it first, but by no means exclusively there. And we do have other caring organisations, retail, manufacturing. I'm at the moment looking at a couple of trials we've got in construction. If anything, the success rate in white collar office type jobs tends to be higher. It tends to be more like, in the high 90s. In other organizations, again, we've got generally positive results, but the success rate's more like, say, 70%. So, but very often when you first go to a company and suggest working 4 days a week, almost always the reaction is, great idea, sounds lovely, but it couldn't possibly work here because we're all so busy. And having that imagination of how things could be different, once everybody starts thinking about how to make things more efficient, comes as a surprise in many organizations. So it's that having the faith in the first place to take that leap. Like I say, everyone, it's always great idea, but it couldn't possibly work here. But and the people are so resourceful in making it work when employees themselves benefit. Normally, when we get a restructuring, if it works, somebody else is getting the benefit. The boss is getting the benefit, the shareholders, the general public. I think one big difference here that allows this quite incredible increase in productivity per hour is that it's the employees themselves that are benefiting. Therefore, they're motivated to make it happen rather than being defensive about it. So Obviously, I can't say it will definitely work everywhere, but the vast majority of companies, and there's a big push at the moment in the UK to try it in the health service, which I think is going to sort itself out. But again, obviously, when people are finding it difficult to see a doctor or nurse and telling them that you want to advocate them working shorter hours to make it more efficient, take some convincing.
So you pointed out that there was a difference between blue collar and white collar jobs. So was the success rate lower because just the general satisfaction or job quality?
There are, because we there aren't many failures, it's actually difficult for us to do these sorts of things statistically. We want big numbers, and like I say, because in over 90% we've got success rate, there aren't many negative cases. And when you do look at those negative cases, often they're very like there's been a takeover, there's a very different structure there now, or they went through, lots of these are small companies and they go through crises, and they went through a crisis. Particularly, it was a turbulent time, like I say, with the Ukraine war had just started, we're still recovering from COVID, so it's a time of a lot of churn in businesses. The two things that we seem to have been able to identify that are general trends are when managers don't make many changes, when they just say, we're going to try a 4-day week, but they don't actually look at how they're going to do things differently, that predicts failure. The other thing that's surprising, and I don't know why this is, but it also predicts failure, and we've looked at the results every way to try and understand what it is, whether it's an artifact. When you have a more male workforce, higher proportion of men to female in the workforce, that again is a, and it's not a big effect, but it's a small, but it does seem to be statistically significant that also doesn't work as well. So we've got a higher success rate when you've got a higher proportion of women in the workforce. And we tried to look at, is it because that's, the sectors they're working in or whatever? It doesn't seem to be that. So something about women maybe more valuing time off, valuing having time to spend more time with their families, more time caring, and so on. I don't know. But yeah, no, it's frustrating that we don't know enough about the failure cases.
But if you're looking at the data from the success rates and then you divide it to women and men employees, is it the same? Or is there a difference between the genders, even in companies where there are male and female workers?
Like I say, if you just, into our statistical models, if we just put the proportion of male workers, the higher proportion of men, the more the failure. When we looked at the individual data on how much people are enjoying it, how much benefit they get in terms of their mental health, then men benefit equally to women. So it's a bit of a puzzle. And when we look at what they do, yeah, of course, we have, as we know in most societies, what we call an unequal domestic division of labor. Women in most households, in many households, do more of the cooking, the cleaning, and the caring. And again, that continues when couples are working a 4-day week. Men do take on more of the childcare, but they also use more of their spare time on hobbies and sports than women do. So there are still gendered effects, and that. But I think, again, looking at the benefits of this, I think one of the big benefits is it is a big move towards gender equality. I think one of the reasons why we still have persistent differentials in pay between men and women and their promotion prospects, the glass ceiling, is because men can work longer hours than women. And very often, and this was the subject of the Nobel Prize in economics a couple of years ago now, that men then tend to work longer hours and women shorter hours as they go into having children, and that perpetuates gender inequality. With a 4-day week, we have the possibility for a new way of working for families. Instead of having a male breadwinner working often longer hours and a woman working part-time, having both parents working a 4-day week and sharing childcare and domestic duties more equally, and sharing, the benefits of work more equally, I think will could be a big the next big step in gender equality.
Sounds really good. So we received a question from the crowd. Was there any fighting regarding whether it was better to take the extra day off on Mondays or Fridays, so extending the weekend, or in the middle of the week instead, like Wednesday, for example?
In some organizations, often when they ask people first, which day off do you want? And when it was an organization that couldn't just close down on Fridays, a lot more people said they wanted Friday off than any other day. And they had to tell people, well, I'm sorry, you can't all have Fridays off. And so people were forced to take Monday off. Sometimes they rotated it. So you'd have like 3 months of taking Mondays off and 3 months of taking Fridays off. There were a small number of people who really enjoyed having, say, like Wednesday off, because they said, like, nobody else is off work, kids are at school, I can just have what often people called me time, just looking after themselves, doing what they wanted to do, more of what they wanted to do, taking their dog for longer walks, whatever it was they enjoyed doing more of that, and doing it in a less hurried way. Again, for some people, a small number of people said they'd prefer to work 5 shorter days. So like 5, 6, 6.5 hour days. Again, for some people that works really well, and it depends on so many factors. The length of the commute. Obviously, if you've got a long commute, going in to work 1 day less a week is a big advantage. Sometimes you've got physically tiring work. And we know that in some jobs, people's performance really drops off in the last 2 hours at work. So then working 5 shorter days might work a lot better. But for most people, certainly their preference is to have 3 days consecutively off each week. As someone said to me just last week, they said it's great having a day when you didn't have to work yesterday and you don't have to work tomorrow and you're not working today. That 3 days, and people like the because we do a lot of as well as collecting all these statistics, we do a lot of qualitative interviews as well, and people wax lyrical about how much better their life is having a 3-day weekend.
Somebody also asked about the tourism example that you provide, for example, that some months were more heavier on work, others were lighter. So were there any benefits in that as opposed to, let's say, a longer weekend?
That was one thing I'm looking for. It particularly was a fish and chip shop on the coast, actually not that far from Cambridge, about 50, 60 miles from Cambridge. There was a fish and chip shop there, and they were saying, well, we do, it's obviously a summer resort. People go to the beach in the summer, and therefore they wanted to continue to work long hours over the summer, but there's no point in everyone being there for long hours in the winter. They just didn't need their staff. So people were the staff were very happy to take more time off in the winter. Again, that's typical that employers vary it to suit their own situation. Again, one thing that's not uncommon is to say, if there's an emergency, if suddenly, like, the whole system goes down, or we've got big problems with sick leave, lots of your colleagues are sick, then we'll want you to come in to work on that Friday or whatever your day off was. One company I can think of said, yeah, if the system went down, they wanted everybody, if they to be on the end of the phone and within an hour to be on the internet, so they could start sorting out problems. And it's the sort of thing that normally, if you said to people, we want you to do this, they would say, what's in it for me? But when you're giving them a 3-day weekend, and then you're saying, but if it's an emergency, we do want you to work. Obviously people are going to be very flexible about that, and so those compromises tend to be very common, and uncontentious people, do seem to be. Like I say, they're benefiting so much, they're very happy to. And they're thinking, people got this new mindset thinking about efficiency in a way that they weren't thinking before.
So there was a follow-up question on that. Was the same effect on mental health felt when the extra time is bunched up in the as in the non-tourist season?
Sorry, I didn't catch that. Say that again.
So, was the same effect in mental health felt when the extra time was as bunched up as in the not?
Do you know what? We haven't had enough data of looking at variability, and there are so many different patterns to be able to say, you know, this is a better way of organizing work than that in terms of mental health. I mean, one thing we can say that for most people, when they something that's been quite common in the United States in particular, that idea of working 4 long days, which some people think is great and again gives them a 3-day weekend, that doesn't seem to have the same benefits of working, say, 4 10-hour days. Yeah, I'd love to be able to answer that question. And like I say, where there was one organization in Belgium, another set of trials that was an organization that was studied very closely, mainly female employees, where they gave people that choice. And initially, some people take shorter days and some people took a day off. But after a while, and when people had a chance to see how it worked out for other people, taking a full day off, having that 3-day weekend, was a much more, people enjoyed a lot more than shorter days. So when people can vote with their feet, yeah, they gravitate towards having Monday or Friday added onto the weekend.
So in the Cambridge trial you mentioned, you said that one of the benefits was that they were able to recruit employees much more easily because it was an attractive workplace all of a sudden. But if this 4-day work week becomes the norm, this loses the whole point. Basically, they will not stand out.
I think that, I mean, that's certainly a scenario. What we haven't thought in detail enough is about, so far we've got really good data, like I say, on employee well-being and on performance. What we haven't been able to think is what happens when the whole, you know, the whole society moves towards a shorter working week. I think what's going to happen is we're going to have continual build-up. There's new companies going to 4-day week all the time, particularly. Several big companies in Italy have made that shift recently. We'll get to a point where any company advertising a 5-day week aren't going to get people applying anymore. And so even those companies that aren't innovators, just like, you know, the last people to want to make a change, are going to be forced to change because otherwise they'll be seen as like they'll be the dinosaurs in the labor market. So, as you say, it'll be that we'll go through different phases. We've been through the phase where it's the most entrepreneurial companies that have moved to 4-day week and they've had what they see as an early adopter advantage. Going from there to it becoming the norm. And there may be organizations that are going to lose out on this, particularly people in the gig economy, the platform economy, people on an hourly rate. And maybe what we're going to see again will vary a lot by country. Between countries is legislation brought in so that those people who are still working long hours when the 4-hour week has become the norm, that they get the benefits of it too. And that might have to be by legislation rather than by market forces and employer-led. But I'm just speculating. But as you say, yeah, we could get to a point where it's the norm and therefore employers aren't getting that advantage anymore. But hey, I think if we get to that point, I will be so happy. Seeing this increase in mental health at the individual level, seeing increase in performance, that even if those companies aren't getting an advantage over other companies anymore, we'll still be in a much better world in terms of mental health, in terms of the parenting that we give, in terms of the, you know, the way that people can think of their lives outside of work and think of the other ways in which they can contribute to their family and to the community, people taking part in, you know, local voluntary organizations, and so on.
By what year do you think that this will become the new norm? And do you think it will extend to academia and schools, kindergarten as well?
We've got a in Portugal as an example of a kindergarten, they've moved to a 4-day week. Again, they've made a slight adjustment for the first 3 weeks of the school year in September. Everybody works a normal 5-day week because that's, you know, you're adjusting, getting hold of new kids in. That's a really intensive time. But then for the rest of the year, all of the nursery nurses are working 4 days a week. Again, they had problems recruiting. But again, in that environment, coming into contact with you have very young children, you get so many bugs. People are off, the sick rate of sick leave is much higher. And so again, they have a rule that, so they had to be actually overstaffed most days because legally they weren't allowed to be understaffed. Now that they can say, if we are understaffed, if there's a spike in sickness, then nobody gets a day off. So, but most of the time, people, their nursery nurses are working 4 days a week. So we've seen it done in a kindergarten. The kindergarten is still open 5 days a week for the parents, for the kids, but the employees are working. We've got a school again. They've gone to a 4 day week, but the school is still open 5 days a week, still the same operating environment. So it can be done in lots of places. In academia, I think we'll be one of the last places to adopt it. I think one of the, and the reason I say that is because one of the things that is important for this transition to work is that you see yourself as working as a team with the people around you. You're all, in the same fate of either in the company succeeds or fails together. For academics, particularly in academics in the Ivy League type universities and Oxford and Cambridge, often it's become very individualized and they're building up their own CV, getting their own publications so that they can then get a job in a better university or get a promotion. And if you'd see it as just as it being in for yourself, rather than being working as a collective team, it might be more difficult to bring about. But having said that, I went to 3 days a week about 5 years ago now, and I have a lot more time just to think. And my productivity, if you just look at my publications over that last 5 years since I went to 3 days a week, is far has gone up massively. And I think, being in a creative job where I'm always, thinking about data, thinking new things, having more time to think, is what I need in my to do my job better, not just more time pressure. And, when you talk to people in creative industries, often they have their best ideas not when they're sitting at a desk, but when they're out walking their dog or in the shower or whatever, just, having that time. So, yeah, I think it will come to academia, but they're not going to be the first.
And by what year do you feel that this will become
Well,
a door?
there were two people who've already made, and people who got almost everything right have made prediction on this. Keynes in the 1930s predicted by the year 2030 we'd all be working 15 days a week, and Karl Marx also predicted for very different reasons that we'd be working much shorter hours. Of course, they got it completely wrong, and so if I make a prediction, I'm certainly going to get it wrong as well. But I think we are at that. Coming up to that tipping point where it's going from being unusual to being more normal. Again, it's, I think when it's not going to get to that tipping point in Asia as quickly. But we're starting to see actually a lot of interest in 4 day week and Bristol 4 day week in South Korea. But yeah, so I think there's going to be real change in the next, say, 10 years or so.
So I have just one last question. We're already running out of time. But you mentioned that this could only work not when just simply cutting off 20% of the hours, but when managers change the way that the company should work. So in what ways do you feel that actually leaders need to change the way work? What's important for this
I
to
think, well,
succeed?
I think what you need to do, what I mean, I'm of the opinion that the people who know their jobs best are the people doing those jobs, not consultants you bring from outside or not even their managers probably. So you need to get everybody at the grassroots level thinking, how could I do my job differently? But in terms of again, what it means from the top, I was talking to quite a senior member of the government a couple of months ago. And I said, if the people working for you work 4 days instead of five, what difference would it make to you? And he said, it was a man, he said, they'd write me, when I asked for a report, they'd write 2-page reports instead of 10-page reports. And I said, which do you prefer? And he said, I prefer 2-page reports. So again, in that case, they would be more efficient. So, but it's, yeah. So, but it's so different. In different organizations, there are different constraints. different opportunities for technology, because again, like I say, people have never really taken technology seriously. Once you say, if you can get the work done, everybody gets Friday off. Suddenly people start thinking, hey, we don't need to, we can use this tool now and whatever. So, but yeah, I think one of the lessons from the research we've done, it has to come from the grassroots, has to be involved from the very beginning.
Thank you so much for this fascinating webinar. I learned so much. I'm sure the other participants learned as well. Thank you everyone who joined us today. Later this month, we'll have another Future of Work session. So thank you again.
Thank you for some great questions. Thank you. Bye.
Again.